Whenever we turn on the TV or like open a news app, we are just completely bombarded with the language of winning and losing.
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere.
Right. Like a politician battles for a demographic or a tennis player conquers the court. Even in business, a startup crushes the competition. We just really, really love scoreboards.
We do, and there's a reason for it. They give us a sense of order, you know?
Yeah, they tell us who's up, who's down, and basically just how the world works.
And that comfort, that exact comfort, is actually the core of the problem we're talking about today. Because games provide this highly structured way to handle conflict or uncertainty.
Because you know the rules.
Exactly. You know who the players are, you can strategize your moves, and at the end of the day, someone raises a trophy. It just makes the world feel manageable.
It's clean.
Yeah.
But then we take that exact same scoreboard mentality, that exact same competitive language, and we drop it straight into the middle of a hospital room or a hospice.
Which is just a conceptual trap.
It really is. Or even just a family conversation about aging. And suddenly, that scorecard is not just unhelpful, it becomes deeply, deeply damaging to everyone involved.
It becomes the absolute definition of cruelty. We take this framework of winners and losers and force it onto people right when they are at their most physically and honestly, emotionally vulnerable.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are digging into a truly perspective-shifting piece of writing. It's Atlas Essay 06, and it's titled There Is No Last Arena.
It's a fantastic piece.
It really is. And our mission for you today, listening to this, is to completely deconstruct a cultural habit that is so deeply ingrained you might not even realize you do it. I definitely
And
didn't.
most people don't.
Yeah. We're talking about the habit of treating illness, suffering, and dying as a quote-unquote battle to be won.
And just to set the stage right out of the gate here, what we're doing today is exploring the philosophical frameworks we use to understand life's limits.
Oh, wait.
We are absolutely not here to offer medical advice or legal advice or to debate the specifics of the healthcare system.
No, definitely not. This is about how we think, not what prescription to write.
Exactly. Our focus is purely on the metaphors we use to make sense of our mortality and how those metaphors literally shape our reality.
So the core premise of this essay is wonderfully simple, but honestly, incredibly heavy. It's just that language matters.
It matters a lot. The language of games, you know, battles, arenas, matches, is a powerful tool for negotiations or sports because those are reciprocal systems.
Like my choice affects your response.
Right, and your counter move affects me. But when we apply that lens to human finitude, we basically turn a biological reality into a competition. And doing that fundamentally mischaracterizes what is actually happening.
Okay, so let's unpack the mechanics of this because I want to understand why we do it. I mean, I get why I might use battle metaphors in a boardroom, but why are we so universally drawn to this arena or game metaphor when it comes to disease?
It's a defense mechanism, really.
Like, why is it our default setting to say someone is fighting cancer or battling an autoimmune disorder?
Because we desperately crave agency when we're faced with the terrifying unknown. I mean, games promise that even when our bodies start to fail, or when a diagnosis completely strips away our normal daily routines,
There's still a way to win.
exactly, there's still a decisive inner victory to be won if we just, you know, play our cards right. A game implies a stake, and it implies a final score that we can somehow influence through sheer willpower.
It gives the illusion of control where maybe there just isn't any.
It whispers a very comforting lie. But the essay argues this is a completely false lens because death and disease are not players.
Right.
A disease has no intentions, it makes no promises, it doesn't sit there, analyze your brilliant medical strategies, and adjust its offense. It simply operates according to biology.
It doesn't recognize a score whatsoever. It's okay. It's like trying to play chess against a hurricane.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. The storm doesn't care about your Sicilian defense, and blaming yourself for getting rained on is absurd. A hurricane isn't trying to outsmart you, it's just weather.
That is a brilliant way to visualize the mismatch. You can't out-strategize a natural force. But this is where the specific cruelty of the game metaphor kicks in. When we use this language of winning and losing, we are quietly turning survival into a merit-based reward.
Wait, unpack that for me. How does saying, like, oh, he's a fighter, turn into a merit system?
Well, think about the implication. If you survive an illness, the cultural narrative tells us it's because you were strong or positive or you battled hard.
Right, you earned it.
Exactly. You earned your survival through your moral character. But the dark flip side of that equation, the shadow it casts on everyone else, is that physical decline, fear, or, you know, dependence on others gets framed as a defeat, a failure of willpower.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a specific phrase from the text that really hit me on this exact point. It's when we say, with the absolute best of intentions, that someone who passed away fought to the end.
We hear that all the time.
All the time. And the essay points out how that casts this incredibly unfair shadow on those who supposedly didn't fight hard enough. We accidentally turn a person's biological limit into a moral failing. We basically say, well, the disease won because they gave up.
It's a massive, crushing burden to place on someone.
It really is.
Now, the essay does note an important caveat here. A military metaphor can mobilize a person if they choose it for themselves.
Sure.
If a patient finds genuine strength in viewing their chemo as a battle, that is entirely their prerogative.
Totally.
But it becomes incredibly unjust when society uses it as the only dignified script available. It creates a situation where, on top of all the physical pain, the loss of independence, the sheer fear of the unknown,
they also have to perform.
Yes.
Yeah.
A person is suddenly burdened with the demand to perform for their audience. They have to play the role of the brave warrior just to make the people around them feel better.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. Let's really stress test this idea.
Let's do it.
If I'm sitting with a loved one who just got a terrible diagnosis and I completely drop the idea of fighting, doesn't that just leave us with giving up?
That is the most common fear.
Right, because if I say, hey, don't view this as a battle, am I just telling them to be passive?
Mm-hmm.
Are we basically advocating for people to refuse treatment and just, you know, surrender to the hurricane?
No, not at all. And it's a crucial question. But rejecting the idea of this last game is absolutely not about passivity. In fact, removing the metaphor restores the literal, actual meaning to our actions.
How so? How does removing the idea of fighting make our actions clearer?
Let's break down the anatomy of a medical action. When we remove the expectation of a final score, the demand for ultimate victory, we can see interventions for what they actually are.
Okay.
Pursuing an aggressive chemotherapy regimen is simply an attempt to alter the biological course of an illness. Administering pain relief is an action designed to reduce suffering in this specific moment.
Setting up a legal trust is about protecting a person's will.
Exactly. None of these are moves on a chessboard designed to checkmate death.
They are just the actions themselves.
Yeah.
Their value is intrinsic to the moment.
Yes. And those actions require immense skill, courage, and dedication from everyone involved, but their value doesn't rely on defeating the ending.
Right.
Let's say a medical team tries a new treatment, and it ultimately doesn't prevent the patient from passing away. If we use the game metaphor, that treatment was a failure and the doctors lost.
But if we strip away the metaphor, the treatment was a valid, meaningful attempt to alter the illness.
Exactly. The care provided was real. Care does not suddenly become a consolation prize just because the patient didn't live forever.
I found so much relief in that perspective, especially for you, the listener. If you have ever been a caregiver or are facing that role now,
it changes everything.
It does. Realizing that helping a loved one manage their pain is a complete, 100% successful action in and of itself.
Yeah.
It's not a failed attempt to cure them.
Yeah.
You didn't lose the game. You successfully provided care. It takes this unbearable weight off your shoulders.
Because where there is no controllable score, the language of games has absolutely no right to determine the value of your actions or the worth of the person you are caring for.
But, okay, if we are taking action, like providing that pain relief or advocating for a patient, without a guaranteed victory, how do we handle the decline of a person's ability to choose?
Ah, right.
Because this is where things get really messy.
Yeah.
When someone's physical capabilities fade due to illness or medication, their agency seems to fade too. How do they participate in these actions if they can, like, barely stay awake?
So the essay introduces a fascinating economic and philosophical concept here, often referred to as the capability approach, which was championed by thinkers like Amartya Sen.
Okay, the capability approach.
Right. We culturally tend to view human freedom and agency as an inner switch. We imagine you either possess total willpower and autonomy, or you are completely incapacitated. The switch is either on or it's off.
Like 100% independent or 0%.
Exactly. But the capability approach argues that a formal right on paper means absolutely nothing without material conditions in reality.
Wait, meaning what?
To actually exercise a choice, to have real freedom, you need a functioning body, you need safety, you need understandable information, and you need social support.
Ah, I see.
The essay uses a brilliant example of a door. A door can be legally open to two different people, but it is not practically open if one person can physically reach the handle and the other is confined to a bed.
So at the limit of life, this distinction becomes the entire ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
Severe pain takes away a person's attention. Heavy exhaustion shortens their memory.
It does. But here is the critical insight. That does not mean their agency drops to zero. Agency fluctuates.
Uh-huh.
A person might not possess the cognitive stamina to organize a complex, multi-stage daily care schedule today, but they absolutely can name one specific person they trust to organize it for them. They might not be able to weigh the statistical probabilities of five different clinical trials, but they can refuse one specific blood draw right now because they are just too tired.
So agency isn't a light switch. It's much more like a cell phone signal.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Just because you drop down to one bar of service out in the woods doesn't mean your phone is completely broken. You just have to communicate differently.
Exactly.
You might not have the bandwidth to stream a 4K movie, but you can still send a vital text message.
That analogy changes everything about how observers and caregivers should react.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of looking at a patient and asking, well, why didn't they just pull themselves together and make a rational long-term decision?
Right. Which is so unfair.
We should be looking at their environment and asking what real possibilities actually existed for them in that specific moment with one bar of signal, and what could we have done to boost that signal?
Which brings us to a huge danger zone. If they're down to one bar, they need a cell tower. They need us.
They do.
The essay discusses the concept of relational freedom, this idea that freedom doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens in a web of other people.
We have this myth in our culture of total self-sufficiency. Like, I do everything myself, therefore I am a free individual.
Which is pretty much never true.
Never. But severe illness really shatters that myth and makes our fundamental dependence on others visible. The essay argues that help isn't something that gets added after agency has failed. Help is often the very mechanism of agency itself.
Meaning the person translating medical jargon for a patient or the medication reducing their pain so they can think clearly is actually what restores their ability to choose.
Yes.
The help isn't replacing their will, it's facilitating it.
If a trusted family member carries your decision into a hospital hallway to argue with a doctor when your own voice is too weak, your will is still acting in the world. Well-designed support expands your real possibilities.
But how do we avoid the trap of taking over someone's life in the name of care? Because if I'm acting as your cell tower, if I'm the one translating your wishes to the medical staff, it is so incredibly easy for my own biases, my own fears about losing you, to just slip into those translations.
It's so easy.
Right. How do I boost your signal without just grabbing the phone and typing the text myself?
It is the ultimate double task of caregiving, and it requires agonizing self-awareness. You cannot abandon someone in the name of respecting their independence, because leaving a severely ill person entirely alone to make decisions isn't freedom, it's isolation.
Absolutely.
But you also cannot take over their life in the name of keeping them safe.
So what's the practical metric for that?
It requires constantly asking the patient and yourself, which part of this decision does this person want to retain right now? What specific burdens are they prepared to delegate to me? And most importantly, how do I, as the helper, keep my own conflicts of interest in check? My desire for them to live longer might directly conflict with their desire to stop experiencing the side effects of a treatment.
Wow.
Caregiving is about preserving the patient's authorship of their own life rather than forcing them to perform independence when they are totally exhausted.
Let's follow that thread to a really uncomfortable place.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say someone's physical agency really has dropped to the bare minimum. They are in pain, they are dependent, and the end is approaching.
Yeah, that one bar of signal.
Exactly. Culturally, this is exactly the moment we usually swoop in and demand that they find a profound meaning in their suffering. We want the silver lining. We want them to tell us what this all taught them.
We do.
But isn't demanding a profound life lesson from a dying person just another way of keeping score? Aren't we just inventing a new game for them to win?
It absolutely can be, and the essay addresses this tension beautifully. It contrasts two profound thinkers who both survived the extreme horrors of the Holocaust, Viktor Frankl and Primo Levi.
Oh, right.
Their vastly different perspectives on survival get right to the heart of this problem.
So Viktor Frankl is famous for his book Man's Search for Meaning, where he basically argues that finding a purpose can save you.
Yes. And Frankl's testimony is vital for understanding human resilience. He shows that even when external freedom is radically narrowed, when you are stripped of your home, your clothes, your basic human rights, a person can sometimes find a particular internal meaning.
Like holding onto a memory.
Exactly. That meaning might be in the memory of a loved one, in a future task they hope to complete, or simply in the dignified attitude they choose to adopt toward their unchangeable suffering.
Right.
Frankl observed that this sense of meaning can gather a person together. It can direct their next action and mentally sustain them through hell.
That sounds incredibly empowering, but what's the catch?
The catch is that Frankl's observation is often twisted by modern culture into a mandatory prescription. Meaning can sustain a person, but that does not turn suffering into a required curriculum sent by the universe for the sake of personal growth.
Definitely not.
And it certainly doesn't guarantee survival. This is where Primo Levi comes in to set a very hard, very necessary boundary.
And Levi's perspective is much starker, isn't it?
Much starker. Levi argues that the survivors of the camps were not a representative sample of everyone who went through the experience. He points out the uncomfortable truth that outcomes often depended on sheer random chance.
Wow.
Survival might have depended on whether you happened to speak the right language to understand a guard's order, or what random work detail you were assigned, or whether you happened to avoid a deadly infection.
It wasn't about who was most enlightened.
Exactly. Survival was not a reward for having a high moral character or a superior ability to find meaning.
There is a philosophical concept that deals with this discomfort, isn't there? The idea that we aren't totally in control of how our lives are judged.
Yes, it's often referred to as moral luck.
Moral luck, right.
It's the unsettling reality that our outcomes, and sometimes even how our lives are morally evaluated by others, depend heavily on circumstances we only partially control.
So if two people have the exact same disease, and one person's body responds well to an experimental drug, while the others doesn't.
The first person isn't morally superior. They just had better biological luck.
Yeah.
Levi wrote about the gray zone, which forces us to acknowledge that extreme suffering doesn't neatly divide people into pure, enlightened heroes and defeated failures.
I think this is where the essay pulls off a brilliant balancing act. It tells us we don't have to pick a winner between Frankl and Levi.
No, we don't.
We don't have to say one worldview is right and the other is totally wrong.
They illuminate different, equally true parts of the human experience. Frankl defends the beautiful possibility that the human mind can sometimes formulate a response that disease or violence cannot entirely erase.
Right.
But Levi protects the victim from having that possibility turned into a heavy, crushing duty.
That is the crucial distinction for anyone navigating this. We can hope that a loved one finds peace or meaning in their final months, but we absolutely cannot demand it as a toll they have to pay to maintain our respect. Like, you don't owe me a profound life lesson just because you're sick. You are allowed to just be angry or terrified or exhausted.
And this ties into a broader philosophical idea that action doesn't need an ultimate cosmic guarantee to be valid. You can resist an illness, you can comfort a friend, you can live your daily life without needing a metaphysical receipt that promises all your suffering will eventually wrap up into a neat, just story.
Right.
Meaning is a possible response to suffering. It is not a hidden property inside the suffering, waiting to be unlocked. And it is certainly not a duty to explain why the suffering had to happen in the first place.
A break in a person's story is not a failure. Sometimes the signal just drops. Sometimes things just break, and it doesn't mean you played the game wrong.
Which brings us to the ultimate question.
Right. If meaning isn't a duty,
yeah,
and our physical control is fluctuating wildly, and we aren't playing a game we can win, what actually guarantees a person's dignity at the limit of their life?
It's the core of everything.
Because if a patient can't perform independence, and they refuse to offer their family a neat, inspiring, philosophical bow to tie around their illness, what is their dignity based on?
There is a foundational rule in ethics that helps anchor us here, going back to thinkers like Kant and later Iris Murdoch and Simone Weil.
Okay.
You must never use a human being merely as a tool to achieve an end, even if that end is your own psychological comfort.
Wow. Yeah.
When someone is dying, they do not suddenly become a set of medical data for doctors to tinker with. They don't become a generic burden on a healthcare system. And most importantly for families, they don't become raw material for someone else's inspiring story about a good, brave death.
Because dignity is unconditional. It's not a VIP pass you earn for good behavior at the end of life.
Exactly. Illness can cause a person to become terrified. They might contradict themselves. They will become heavily dependent on care, and they might become incredibly difficult, angry, or bitter toward their loved ones.
Which is completely natural.
It is. But fear, dependence, and anger do not strip a human being of their intrinsic worth. They do not turn a person into an object.
How do we practically maintain that view when we are in the thick of it, when the caregiving is exhausting and the patient is really difficult?
By practicing what some philosophers call the ethics of attention, it is the rigorous discipline of truly looking at the specific, particular person in front of you.
Before we apply the labels.
Yes. Before we decide this patient is a fighter or a tragic victim or a saint, we have to strip away our own anxieties and simply attend to their reality. We have to see the flawed, complex human being rather than the narrative role we have prepared for them.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? It means that whether you are caring for someone else or facing your own physical limits, you do not lose your status as a human being just because you lose a physical ability.
Dignity precedes the outcome.
It's built into your blueprint. Your capacity to choose might diminish to a single bar of cell signal, but the demand for others to attend to your pain, to respect your will, and to maintain human connection with you, that demand never, ever disappears.
That is exactly why the act of caring is not measured only by how long it prolongs a heartbeat.
Right.
Reducing someone's pain, fulfilling a simple, mundane request for a glass of water, or just sitting silently in a room so they don't have to be alone, these are real, tangible, successful changes in the world.
They don't defeat death.
And they don't need to. Their value lies purely in one human being's compassionate response to another.
This has been such an incredible journey. Let's synthesize where we've landed with this essay. Finitude, just the simple, unavoidable fact that our time and energy are limited, makes our choices incredibly costly.
It does.
Saying a lasting yes to one path means refusing another. If you choose to dedicate your life to a demanding career, it might cost you time with your family. If you prioritize absolute safety, it might cost you creative risk. We are always trading one value for another.
And death does not magically step in at the end to resolve these conflicting values. It doesn't hand you a final score to prove objectively that you lived the right life or made the perfect trades.
Right, because love, justice, duty, comfort, they don't all fit neatly on one scale.
But realizing that there is no last arena, realizing that there is no final scoreboard waiting for us, is actually profoundly freeing.
It frees us from the exhausting, impossible duty to win against biology.
Exactly. And when you finally strip away the battle metaphor, what you are left with isn't a void of giving up. You're left with much more precise, beautiful, and honest languages. The language of medicine, of law, of ethics, of love, of grief, and of simple attentive presence.
I love that.
As we wrap up, I want to take this framework and push it into a slightly different arena for everyone listening. We've talked a lot about severe illness and the end of life. But think about how the battle metaphor completely dominates the modern wellness and anti-aging industry.
Oh, wow.
We are constantly sold the idea that aging itself is a disease we must fight with the right supplements, the right ice baths, the right routines. If you view aging as a war you are obligated to wage, every new wrinkle or ache becomes a personal defeat.
That is so true.
So my question for you to mull over today is this. If you drop the demand to win against time, if you accept there is no final arena where you conquer your own biology, how might that change the way you treat your body today? What exhausting wellness battles could you surrender, not to give up on your health, but to simply inhabit your life with more peace?
That is a brilliant application and a question truly worth sitting with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning the metaphors you use to build your reality. And remember, you can put away the chessboard. You don't need to outsmart a hurricane. We'll catch you next time.